high of 73. Some southerly winds up to 20 miles per hour. Right now, sunny and 59 degrees were seen, 58 this morning in Kenosha. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
And we welcome you to the Thursday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. I'm excited to tell you about a wonderful guest that is coming to the campus of Carthage College on Monday, the 7th of November, speaking at 12 noon as part of the Spotlight on Sports speaker series. They have brought some big names to campus, and on Monday, the next guest is Molly Fletcher. Molly Fletcher is someone who really paved the way as one of the first women to be at really the top echelon of sports agents and has gone on to an exciting career as well as an author five times over, motivational speaker, and host of a terrific podcast called Game Changers with Molly Fletcher. Her books include Fearless at Work, The Business of Being the Best, A Winner's Guide to Negotiating Your Dream Job Game Plan, and most recently, The Energy Clock. And again, her podcast, Game Changers with Molly Fletcher, is something I highly recommend. She's coming to Carthage at noon on Monday, November 7th, and we'll give you information a little later on the hour on how you can register to attend this very, very special event. And I appreciate Molly Fletcher making time in a busy schedule and a busy life to be my guest for this portion of the morning show. Molly Fletcher, we welcome you.
Thanks so much. It's great to be with you.
It's always an interesting experience for me to talk to somebody who themselves is an interviewer and a really good one. And I want to say that one of the things I really appreciate about your podcast is just how crisp and focused it is. I think some people maybe enjoy podcasts that kind of amble and meander, and I'm not a big fan of those. I just feel like my time is too valuable, and I appreciate a podcast in which there's been great preparation and there's a real focus to the topic at hand, and you bring that and other gifts to it. So my congrats to you.
Thanks so much, Greg.
Let's talk about your career as a sports agent and the fact that you kind of paved the way or entered that arena at a time when it was really quite uncommon for women to be part of that world. First of all, did anything in particular motivate you to want to pursue that possibility?
Well, probably like a lot of the young people at Carthage, you know, I love sports. I played tennis at Michigan State, and after I graduated, I wanted to get into the business of sports, but you know, the truth is I really didn't know what that meant or what that looked like. I had very little clarity. I just knew that I loved the sports business. And as I began to do various jobs out of college, you know, from answering the phones of the Super Bowl host committee to working at a high ropes adventure company to all kinds of different things, I began to sort of hone in and notice what I really loved. And I started with a small agency doing marketing deals for the athletes and coaches that we have. We had about four or five clients, and I really loved it. I loved the opportunity to help maximize what is such a short window of time as a professional athlete or at times a coach. So it was a wonderful opportunity to support them. And I found that it was obviously a very relationship-intensive business where they're really leaning on you to tell them the truth. And as I said, maximize a short window of time. And I began to love that. And I think, like, if you follow your heart and you close a gap in the market, you're probably going to have some success. And that's what I've always tried to do.
What kind of resistance did you face being a woman in a business in which, at that point in time, there were very few women? Was that a significant issue for you, or for whatever reason, did you not find a lot of resistance or difficulty because of your gender?
Sure. I mean, there was absolutely moments, right, where I would be the only woman behind a big league, you know, ballpark, you know, at home plate, right, during batting practice, and managers would mistaken me as a girlfriend or a wife, right? What is this? What is she doing here, right? We're hitting BP, or, you know, on the range of a tour event, and often, you know, mistaken as a manufacturer's rep or a wife. And there was moments like that, absolutely. But what I always try to encourage people to do in those moments is reframe them. You know, reframe them and say, what are the gifts in this, and how can I lean into those gifts, and how can being different be a benefit, potentially even an advantage? And when I shifted and recognized the gifts in being different, the gifts in being a woman, to approach the business in a way that was different than the people I competed with, it in fact became a tremendous advantage, because I would often, if it was a male athlete, I would, you know, sometimes recruit the wives and connect with them, and they would go, you know, to their husbands and go, I don't even know your agent, right? Like, you get traded and get on an airplane and leave, and I'm sitting here with two cars, and I'm pregnant, and a house, and I need help too. So I really built a team around the male athletes that I had and tried to pour into them. So, you know, it's all about mindset, Greg, in my opinion, and I think that we all, in whatever industry we're in, probably bump into challenges and obstacles, and I think we have to ask ourselves, what are the gifts in this? How can I shift my mindset, find the benefit? And at the end of the day, focus on serving the people that I want to serve the most, and probably the outcomes will follow.
Hmm. Speaking of the people that you wanted to serve, what would determine what kind of athletes you would represent? Or I guess another way to frame this is, were there particular qualities that you looked for in terms of people that you wanted to have as clients? I mean, what kind of athletes were you looking for, and did you maybe feel best about representing as their agent?
Sure. You know, obviously, I mean, you want them to have a ton of potential, but you also want them to be a great person. And that was always important. And then the business is so tight and so small at some level that I also wanted to ensure that my existing clients liked that particular athlete or coach. And so, you know, when I started at our agency, we had a few coaches and a baseball player. And so I often really tried to pour into the talent that we had and then lean into them for support with the kind of athletes, coaches that we wanted to go after. And, you know, there was times when I would identify, I remember once identifying a golfer that I wanted to go after, and I asked a couple of my existing tour players, and they said, if you come into town to a tournament to see me, we're probably not all going to dinner together, right? So I paid attention to that a lot, and I wanted to make sure that at some level I was building a bit of a family of athletes that liked each other. So if I flew into Chicago to go see two teams playing each other and see, you know, four or five clients at the same time, I wanted to make sure that they respected and appreciated each other. So, and it's a business, as you can imagine, it's 24/7. I mean, my phone rang constantly. I slept with my phone. I had pajamas with pockets in it so that I could take calls pretty much any time. And so, you know, and as a wife and a mother with young kids, if it was a Saturday afternoon and I was pushing my daughter on a swing and I looked down, I mean, I wanted to like them at the end of the day, right? I wanted to like them and want to take their call. So those were all things that I paid attention to. And like all of us in life, you know, as your career progresses and you have potentially a little bit more success, you have an opportunity to get even more selective, and I tried to do that as well.
We're speaking with Molly Fletcher, a one of the first women to kind of blaze the trail as a sports agent at the highest levels of professional sports, now a very busy author, motivational speaker, and podcast host, and coming to Carthage on Monday, November 12th. So one of the things about professional sports is that we hear horror stories about professional athletes being spoiled and privileged and kind of expecting everyone to be at their beck and call and so on. I wonder, as someone who has worked with more than your fair share of professional athletes, some of them out-and-out superstars, how much truth is there behind that stereotype? And over the years, did you deal with those kind of athletes versus those that would be essentially the opposite? I mean, people not selfish, but selfless, and you know, the kind of people whom we would admire for those kind of reasons beyond their athletic prowess.
Absolutely. Well, like in any business, I mean, there's all kinds of people, right? And certainly it runs the gamut in sports as well. And you know, they live in a world where often, you know, they fly private, they land, somebody pulls their bags off the bottom, puts them in a you know, bus, they get to the hotel, somebody hands them their room keys, their bags are brought up to the room. I mean, it's a different world. And so the athletes that I loved working with were the ones that never forgot where they came from, were the ones that recognized that that's unique, were the ones that recognized that at some point was going to end, and that the people that were supporting that were people, and they needed to appreciate and respect them. And so I always wanted to try to work with athletes that recognized that the platform that they had was unique, and it was a platform at some level that they could certainly use to do great things in the world beyond what they did on the plate or the field or the court. They needed to leverage that. And, you know, guys like John Smoltz, I mean, Smoltz, you know, is a dear friend and was a client for almost 20 years. And you know, John is a guy who absolutely uses and has his platform to do great things. And, you know, do they know they're good at what they do and are they confident? Yes, but there's a big difference between that and, you know, walking around with an ego and feeling as if you are above others. And John's a guy that has said, how can I give back? And you know, he's built a school in Atlanta to give back to kids. I mean, he was the guy that would call me up on, you know, Thanksgiving morning, Christmas morning, and he'd be popping over to the children's hospital, but tell me, don't you dare tell anybody I'm headed that way when we were talking. And no, he didn't want anybody to know. And, you know, Tom Izzo, a Midwest guy, a client forever, the Michigan State men's basketball coach. I mean, Tom is one of the best. I mean, a blue collar guy who's never, ever forgotten. You know, he told me the other day, he said, Molly, I was outside mowing my lawn and a guy drove by and says, wow, Tom, you mow your lawn? And Tom was like, do you mow your lawn? He goes, well, yeah. And Tom goes, well, then why can't I? You know, and I love those kind of guys. So, and gals. So there's absolutely ego, no question. And I think one of the things that was important when we sort of think about this is because they don't have a ton of people around them that tell them the truth, one of the things that I always valued was building really, really strong relationships with the athletes that I worked with, where they knew that the things that I was delivering to them, telling them, sharing with them was always coming from, you know, a place that was authentic and a place that was clearly centered and trying to help make them better, to help them be the best version of themselves in the clubhouse, you know, on the sideline, you know, on the golf, whatever it was. And that's a powerful thing because they don't have a lot of people around them that tell them the truth. And as an agent, I felt like it was incredibly important that I always was able to do that. And I did. And to me, that's something I'm really grateful for because they need it.
Mm. What would you say would be the biggest misunderstandings that the public has about what people in this line of work do? By that, I mean the sports agent. I mean, what would be probably the most significant misunderstandings that the general public has about what you do?
I would say one is, you know, are you an attorney? And a lot of people think you have to be an attorney to be an agent, and you don't. And I am not an attorney. As an agency, we had in-house counsel that helped from a legal perspective, review all of our contracts. I would say, you know, probably the other thing is that it's just unbelievably glamorous, right? It is a 24/7 fire drill at some level. When you know, I had recruited over 15 years about 300 athletes and coaches, and you can imagine with 300 athletes or coaches that broadcasters that the phone rang all the time. I mean, guys and gals were getting fired and hired, released, traded, called up, called down, missing cuts, making cuts, winning tournaments, you know, and it was 24/7. And so it isn't about going and sitting behind home plate every day and sort of that life, right? I mean, certainly you do some of that, absolutely. But at the end of the day, it's about serving these guys and gals, and you know, it's not about private planes and fancy boats. I mean, there's some of that, but at the end of the day, you can't forget what you're there to do, which is to maximize an unbelievably unique window of time for these athletes.
Hmm. Can you make any generalizations about what you see in terms of the athletes in various sports? And I know that you have represented top athletes in an array of different sports. Is it possible to generalize about what really good professional baseball players tend to be like versus basketball versus football? And I only ask that because those various sports are all, of course, team sports, but they're all also quite distinct from each other in terms of kind of the dynamics of the game and the relationships that tend to be between players and so on. Or is it just impossible to generalize about something like that?
Well, no, I mean, I think they're wired a little different, no question. And you know, to me, golfers are, they're independent contractors. So they're only as good as their last tournament, unless they've won a tournament or won a major and they have an exemption. So they wake up every day having to ensure that they keep their job unless they've won a tournament. And so that mindset's a little bit different. I mean, that's a mindset of, you know, I've got to go out and execute. And so they're a little bit nervous sometimes. They're a little bit anxious. They're a little bit all those things because they have got to execute every tournament, every week to get it done. And they're paying for all their own stuff, right? I mean, they're traveling, they're buying their own tickets. If they miss their cut, they make no money. And then they have and then they have to, you know, fly their family if their family travels with them back home. So it's just a different mindset as an independent contractor and someone who has to, you know, wake up every day and sort of make putts to at some level feed themselves. I remember once when one of my golfers, one of my baseball players was under like a $15 million deal, an annual deal, and he literally got injured. And I remember one of my golfers going, wait, so let me understand this. Like he's getting his $16 million all year, even though he's never stepping on the plate or the mound. And I go, right. And so that's just a different mindset for a golfer. So golfers are independent contractors. They're different. Baseball players, you know, they're unbelievable people also, obviously. But, you know, they make their way through the minor league system. I mean, most baseball players, you know, they get drafted. If they get drafted in a top round, then they get paid, you know, a good bit of money. But at the end of the day, they've got to percolate through the minor league system, which sometimes takes 4 or 5 years to get to the big leagues. And then they don't really, you know, hit anything interesting, if you will, until they hit free agency and arbitration. So that's a little bit of a different deal as well. I mean, coaches, at some level, they're the kind of people that have had to grind and work for where they are. They have gotten there, you know, through often becoming an assistant coach and have had to kind of grind it through that process. And then they get that head coaching job, which is obviously incredibly unique and special. And some of them go to the NBA. We had NBA coaches. Broadcasters have a little bit of that golf mindset, Greg. I mean, you know, they're often under shorter term deals unless you're, you know, Barkley or some of the other guys. And so they also, depending on the level of progress they've made in their career and to where they are in their career, they have to, you know, get after it a little bit as well and show up every day. And obviously they live in a world, as you know, where they're under a microscope at some level. And in the world that we're in, they have to be remarkably careful with how they navigate that. So
Great question, and they definitely do show up a little bit different, all of them, no doubt about it.
Right. I think I was thinking in those terms because I just interviewed the author of a book about Bo Jackson, the great baseball player and football player, and of course, his experience on the baseball diamond versus the football field. They were very different experiences for him. They both meant a lot to him. But So I figured that that probably translates into other differences as well. Over the course of the many years that you were a very active sports agent, how would you say the world of professional sports in general changed the most? And in particular, changed in ways that really affected the kind of work that you and your colleagues do as agents?
Well, I would say really the onset of social media was a really big shift. And, you know, I was in the business day after day at that time, and that was a huge shift. I mean, it changed some things as it relates to, obviously, marketing and endorsement deals. It's changed a lot of things, of course, now. But when it first hit, and I remember looking at some of my athletes going, hey, man, we got to get at, you know, at John Smoltz, you know, at Mark DeRosa, at Ernie Johnson, at Doc Rivers. And they're like, what is this Twitter thing? I mean, this is weird. I'm going to tell people what I'm doing all day. I'm going to take pictures of my, I mean, so it was a real sort of interesting dynamic, candidly, as I reflect back on some of those conversations when I said, hey, Aaron Andrews, you know, we need to grab your handle across some of these platforms. And now, you know, she's like, I'm not doing that. That's crazy. And now she's got, you know, however many million followers. And obviously, you know, part of that play for athletes and broadcasters, celebrities, et cetera, is obviously marketing opportunities. So that was a really big one, Greg, when it hit. And then, of course, now I think it's just going to be interesting how, you know, NIL, college sports, what that does to the pro landscape and how that plays in will be interesting. Obviously, what's changed in college sports is pretty significant as of late with NIL, the transfer portal, all that has changed the way my coaches navigate what they do and how they do it. And then, of course, it's really at some level almost a minor league system for pro sports, too.
It's a fascinating arena to follow, even beyond the actual games being played. I guess it's other games being played behind the scenes. Before I let you go, I do want to talk just a little bit about what I was talking about at the outset, about the really marvelous work that I think you do in your podcast, Game Changers, with Molly Fletcher. And we should say, for the sake of any listeners who have not yet encountered this podcast, that although you have talked to a few of your former clients or present clients, including Hall of Fame pitcher John Smoltz that you mentioned earlier, that most of your guests are people you have no professional connection with whatsoever, but you are wanting to talk with them and share their message for other reasons. Explain kind of the wide scope of this podcast and why you chose to approach it that way.
Well, the intent of the podcast is to provide content and share conversations with the world, with people who have a unique lens, have had a unique journey, have a great story, who are game changers. And so I feel incredibly fortunate and blessed to have been able to have these kinds of conversations and share them with people. I mean, we've, you know, Matthew McConaughey, Priyanka Jonas, you know, John Mackey from Whole Foods. We've tried to talk with, you know, entrepreneurs, business owners, leaders inside of large organizations, certainly athletes, coaches. You know, Joe Gebbia recently, the founder of Airbnb. We've just had some wonderful, wonderful guests. And, you know, to me, it's about bringing a conversation forward in a way that allows people to lift it up and apply it to their life, apply it to their work, apply it in a way that's different maybe than the kinds of conversations they've heard potentially similar guests on other shows, to challenge these guests to ask different kinds of questions. And at the end of the day, with an intent to, as you said, and as we shared, for people to be able to go, wow, that's interesting. I'm going to try that in my own life. I mean, I had a monk on, Don DuPonti, and, you know, I've had a lot of comments on that podcast. And, you know, Dabo Sweeney, head coach at Clemson. I mean, really, really incredible guy at such a high level who's had so much success, of course, as well. So, and from every single guest, I'd say, Greg, I learn so much and learn so many unique and different things. I think years ago we put together sort of all the incredible kind of one-liners I've gotten from these guests, and it was just profound. So thank you for mentioning it. We certainly welcome folks to check it out. It's an honor and a blessing to be able to talk to these folks and share these game changers with the world.
Again, the podcast is called Game Changers with Molly Fletcher, and she is also the author of an array of books, most recently The Energy Clock. Quickly tell us about what you write about in this most recent book.
Well, The Energy Clock is really a result of living in a world of sports where I watched athletes look at their life through the lens of energy, not time. Right? Tom Brady, Serena Williams, LeBron James, they're not obsessed with their calendars as much as they are the kinds of things they need to do to perform at their very best in the moments that matter most. And then when I stepped away and I saw the way business people approached their life and their days as it relates to performing at their best, it was fascinating because I thought, wow, this is interesting. Business people are obsessed with their calendars. They're not necessarily focused on the moments they have to show up at their best, for that big meeting on Thursday at 4 o'clock, or that huge sales pitch, or that tough conversation that they've got to be ready for. And I thought, this is amazing. They accept all these meetings, and then they show up to the one that matters most that week, and they don't have the kind of energy they need to execute in that moment. And I help my athletes consistently, if it was a PGA Tour player, manage their schedule in such a way that they ensured they peaked at the majors in the big moment, that the tournaments where they performed traditionally at their best. And I thought, wow, what if I could help business people look at their schedules through the lens of energy so they could perform at their best in the moments that mattered most? And that's what that book is about. And that book is a result, truthfully, of what I saw in the sports space, but then at the same time, some moments in my own life where I didn't manage my schedule well, I didn't manage my energy well, and I felt exhausted and drained and burned out and disconnected from my girls, our daughters, my husband, and I thought, man, I got to align energy and time and look at this through. And so the book teaches people a process for that, a way to do that, that allows them at the end of the day to ensure they're chasing the right stuff. Nothing breaks my heart more than people who get to the end of their weeks, their days, and they don't know what they're chasing. And I think we all have to ask ourselves that. What am I chasing and why? Because it's easy to get busy, you know, and we can't confuse activity with accomplishment. Mm-hmm. And I believe it's incredibly important to ensure that we align our values and our purpose with where we put our energy in our life.
Well said. Again, that book, the most recent of Molly Fletcher's books, is called The Energy Clock. Molly Fletcher comes to the campus of Carthage College and speaks at 12 noon as part of the Spotlight on Sports speaker series. We'll give information in a moment on how you can register for this event to come and enjoy Molly Fletcher's presence and energy in person. Molly Fletcher, thank you so much for making time for this conversation today, and very best wishes with all that you continue to do. And thank you again for being a guest on The Morning Show.
It's an absolute pleasure, and I can't wait to be at Carthage. I'm really, really looking forward to it. It's going to be an amazing day.
Great. And Molly Fletcher's talk at Carthage on November 7th is free and open to the public, but registration is required. To register, go to the Carthage website, carthage.edu. Up at the top, click on News and Events. And then to the left of the screen, click on Events Calendar and find for Monday, November 7th, Molly Fletcher's visit. And there will be a button right there that you click on in order to register for this free event. Molly Fletcher, Monday, November 7th, 12 noon in the Todd Weir Center. You're listening to the Thursday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. Here's part two from the Morning Show archives. I'm excited to be reconnecting with best-selling author Kostya Kennedy, who was my guest for the Morning Show to talk about a very important book of his called Lasting Impact, One Team, One Season. And What Happens When Our Sons Play Football, a very interesting book about the risks of football, and but also the strong hold that it has over a large swath of the American public, including plenty of young people who want to play this game despite its risks. And I'm reconnecting now with Kostya Kennedy to talk about his latest book, which is actually published by Sports Illustrated, titled The Story of Baseball in 100 Photographs. It is a marvelous book that celebrates the sport of baseball in very striking fashion by presenting an array of 100 different photographs, many of which capture some of the most important superstars of the game and or critical moments in baseball history. And some of these photographs, on the other hand, capture moments that are, in a sense, much more ordinary and everyday, but help illuminate the public's love of baseball and the special hold that this sport has on so much of the public. It's beautifully done, and I'm excited to be able to speak with Kostya Kennedy about this collection from Sports Illustrated again, The Story of Baseball in 100 Photographs. Kostya Kennedy, we welcome you back to the morning show.
Thanks so much, Greg. It's great to be on with you.
I'm really impressed with this book. You wrote the foreword to it. Is that your primary involvement in this book, or did you have any hand in the selection of these actual 100 photographs?
No, actually, I did write the foreword, as you mentioned. I was the editor of the book throughout. So I, of course, with a team, with a photo editor and a designer and a couple of other people, but we selected the photos and tried to weave together a bit of a narrative, photograph by photograph, of this wonderful game.
Right. You've made great selections, and we'll talk about some of the specific choices in just a moment. I wonder if you could maybe expand on a really great quote that you include from someone who was a former colleague of yours at Sports Illustrated for about a quarter of a century, Ronald Modra, who says, "When you're shooting baseball, you're waiting. You're waiting and you're attentive." Explain how, especially once upon a time, being a photographer for the game of baseball was in such large measure a waiting game.
Yeah, it's a wonderful quote, and I included that in the foreword of the book because it sums up a lot of the challenge. Ron's a wonderful photographer. I was able, as a senior writer at Sports Illustrated for a long time, and we'd be on stories together. You know, in baseball, perhaps more than any other mainstream sport, you don't know really where the action's going to be, particularly in the field, right? You can get a pitcher in his windup. You know you can get a batter in his stance. But if you're looking for a great fielding play in particular, or a play at the base, it's often difficult to know. There's no way to know where it's going to happen. So you have to get a little lucky. And baseball, as we know, you know, what Ron says about taking photographs is also a little bit of what we do as consumers and viewers and those of us who love the game. There are moments of intense action that are very quick, and then you're sort of waiting to see what develops in between. So as he mentioned, when he was shooting the Yankees, for example, in the late 70s and early 80s, when the Yankees were in the field, he would often just train his camera on Greg Nettles, who played third base and was a wonderfully acrobatic and elegant fielder at third base, and he felt he had a good chance of getting a good picture if the ball was hit to him. Now, of course, the ball's only hit to him a few times a game, so it's a risk-reward situation, but he felt, and other photographers who I spoke to felt, that when you're shooting baseball, if you spend a day there and you get one or two really good or even great photographs of the kind that sort of elevate outside the game, it's been a great day, and that's what you can hope for.
Right. I really appreciate some of what you explain in the introduction to the book about how these 100 photographs were selected, and how this is, for one thing, by no means the 100 most famous baseball photographs. In a sense, although that would be a great book, but I don't think that would be nearly as interesting a book as this book is, which certainly does have its share of famous photographs from baseball. But that's not all this is. This book is more than that. Explain a little further what went into your thinking process, you and those who helped you select these 100 photographs.
Yeah, it was a big challenge, right? And you start off with the challenge of getting 100 photographs, and you could take it in any number of directions, of course, as you're suggesting in your question. So baseball's about to turn 150. The first openly professional baseball team with the Red Stockings in 1869. And we were using this opportunity, and are using it, to try to tell a narrative of the game, truly to tell a story of baseball over time and over players and over context and over shifts in the game and, of course, over sometimes intersections with the American society at large. So we had sort of a high threshold of what would get in. Of course, the picture had to look pleasing. It had to be aesthetically beautiful or compelling in some way. I wanted pictures to be those that you could stay with a little bit, or you could come back to and maybe see something new or see something in a different light. So there was some depth to a photograph. And then also there was content was crucial, meaning that it would wanted to tell a little bit of a story, have a person who is important to the game there, or a game itself, or a time, or, you know, whether it's showing a bullpen cart because of what an important part of the game that was for a little period in the 70s, or whatever it might be. So we're trying to tell over the whole a narrative and have the pictures connect in some way to their time and to the overall story of the game. I should just mention briefly, with each picture we have about, 250 words of text or so, we hope evocative text, which give a little background and context, a little bit extra to the photograph, so people can really dig in and understand what's happening and what they're looking at.
Right. And I also appreciate the fact that the book is separated by time periods. So, for instance, the first section of the book is titled Beginnings, appropriately enough, and spans the years 1869 to 1919. And there are some very, very fascinating pictures in this section that include some early luminaries of the game, including Cy Young and Ty Cobb caught in action. I actually would love to have you say just a quick word about a photograph in this section, which you headline "Beginning of the World." This is a photograph taken in Boston in the fall of 1903, and it is a remarkable image indeed.
Yes, it's a picture of the first World Series games at a place called Huntington Avenue Grounds in Boston, and it's a big, widespread shot. There weren't that you mentioned the Ty Cobb picture from 1910, which was a beautiful action picture. There wasn't that much action in those days as what people shot, but this was not action, but a big, wide angle looking at the field. And what's so remarkable about it is you see all the people who've come to watch the game, and they're just crowding in. They're on the outfield. They're standing on the big slatted wooden fence. They're packed in to see this incredible spectacle, and very close to the field, as one can see, much closer than you would ever have people today. Obviously, you wouldn't have people on the field at all today, but it's an incredible photograph, I think, because it evokes such a time. It evokes the excitement of this new game. It's relatively new. It's 1903. This is the first World Series. Shows so many people there, so close to the game. You can see people aren't. You understand by looking at this picture that people don't hit the ball as far as they do now in those days, because you wouldn't be able to have people so encroached. So there's a lot about it, along with period advertisement signs for a local shoe shop and things like that, which really make it a powerful picture to look at, I think.
Absolutely. And I'm glad you made mention of the fact that we have very few true action shots from the early years of baseball, which makes the image, for instance, of Ty Cobb all the more precious. It's well, you describe it, this wonderful photograph that captures Ty Cobb and his greatness.
Yeah, so he's coming really hard into third base, basically almost barreling over the third baseman. You see the his foot hitting the bag. Again, these pictures become so revealing. You can see that the bag is kind of a soft bag. It's almost a pillow. It's changed a lot over time. And there's dirt flying everywhere. The umpire in the background is looking to make his call on the play. Cobb has an expression of great intensity on his face. And it's an amazing picture because, it's Ty Cobb, right? And we're seeing him in 1910 and at the height of his powers and what he was as the greatest player in the game at that time. And as we were saying, it's also very rare in those days to see action like this. This really stood out. There are some beautiful pictures from that time, like the World Series one we just described, but often the player pictures are portraits on the sideline of a pitcher going into his windup, perhaps, or a batter taking a little bit of a swing. The action photography didn't really begin until the 20s, 30s, and then more so in the 40s and 50s. It was much harder to get because of the quality of camera in those days, and it was just not in vogue, really, to do it nearly as much as it would become.
Right. We're speaking with Kostya Kennedy, the editor of a wonderful new book from Sports Illustrated called The Story of Baseball in 100 Photographs. I know people will greedily devour the chapter that covers 1920 to 1947, and you title it From Ruth to Robinson. In many ways, that title is all that we need to hear, although there are a whole lot of other luminaries from this period of the game who are captured here as well. I want to just ask you about the photograph that you chose of Babe Ruth. I mean, as you just said, by this point, photography had advanced to the point where there are just countless possibilities, yeah, in terms of great photographs of the wonderful Babe Ruth in action. But I love the photo that you selected, although I've never seen it before. Explain what led you to choose it.
Yeah, so as you say, a player like Ruth or DiMaggio or later on Pete Rose or any number of players, there are many choices you could make. One thing to remember is, so say something like Babe Ruth called shot in the 1932 World Series. There's not really a great picture of it, right? There's a little tiny, grainy image, but there's not a picture that you would even consider including in a book of great photography or as something to really hold up at a good size. But there are many, many pictures of Ruth in many different ways. We chose the picture where he's finishing his mighty swing. You see him sort of in full power. His hips are swiveled. The back of his leg is extended. His front leg, his right leg is bent, and his bat is high on the follow-through. He just hit a home run. He's looking up at it. Both the catcher, who's risen from his crouch, and the umpire also following the flight path of the ball. And you also see the shadows on the dirt there, the shadows of both Ruth and the catcher behind him. It's at Sportsman Park in St. Louis, where Babe and a lot of other people hit quite well against the Browns in those days. And it just seemed you were really seeing Babe Ruth doing what he did. Obviously, he did so many other things, and he was a big, larger-than-life star outside the game, and the way he was so jovial and the raconteur and all that, and also did so much on the field. He could run well, and he was obviously a great pitcher. He did so much well. But the thing that he did, obviously, was hit home runs. And here you are seeing him, the power of Babe Ruth, on just a day in October in 1926, and it's one of his home runs, and it really seemed to encapsulate with this picture to tell the larger story of who Babe Ruth was and what he did for the game.
I love this photograph so much. This whole section is peppered with superstars from Joe DiMaggio to Ted Williams to the legendary Satchel Paige. I really appreciate the thoughtful choice you made to capture the great Lou Gehrig. This is another photograph I've never seen before. I've seen ones like it. There are all kinds of photographs from this powerful, poignant moment when Lou Gehrig bade farewell to the game he loved so much. But describe to our listeners the photograph that is here, and again, why you thought this was the perfect photograph to include.
So it's Lou at Yankee Stadium on July 4th, 1939, and he's on the field with several microphones set up on tripods in front of him, and he's delivering the speech that we've come to know and has made its way into the American lexicon of the luckiest man speech, where he knows that he has ALS and he's still says he considers himself the luckiest man on the face of the earth. It's a powerful picture for what you see in Lou with his head slightly bent. He's not actually speaking. He's in pause at that moment. And also the men you see behind him looking at him and understanding the courage that they're seeing. Here, the case, you know, Lou Gehrig was an all-time, obviously, great, great, great ball player. There are plenty of pictures of him hitting or fielding or doing something that we could have shown. But what Lou Gehrig did in the way he faced this disease and in his bravery and composure really slipped the bounds of the game. And there aren't as many times as one would think that baseball does that. Of course, it's wrapped up into American society, but moments like Lou Gehrig or Jackie Robinson, Roberto Clemente aren't quite as many as one would think. And this really seemed to be one where he was making a mark not just on the baseball world, but on the world at large, and felt like the right way to honor him and what he's given us.
Right. One very special moment in baseball history was the perfect game thrown by Don Larsen. And please describe the great photograph that is here that captures this moment on October 8th, 1956.
Yeah, one of the things I love about it, so it's he's in the arms of Yogi Berra, Don Larsen is having just finished his perfect game, and it shows you sort of what a big guy Don Larsen is, because Yogi wasn't tall, but Yogi was a big heavy catcher, and it's Don who's picking up Yogi Berra, so it gives you a sense. I think Larsen was about 6'4", and gives you a sense of his size and his strength. And you see people, security people, and everybody spilling onto the field and coming close to them. The Yankees are beginning to celebrate. The Dodgers' first base coach is turning to leave the field, and again, it captures a singular moment. Here was a case when one of the landmark games, you know, one of the 10 or 15 games that will go down as the all-time games in baseball history, there was a great picture of it, and it was a great moment. And Larsen, whose career otherwise might not have merited a telling in the overall story of baseball, but certainly through this October day in 1956, warranted being in there.
Absolutely. I want to mention that there are several photographs that have a local connection to our listeners. For instance, a really interesting picture of the Braves having just moved from Milwaukee to Atlanta, and that story is talked about. There's a great picture of the Kenosha Comets. They were one of the women's teams active during World War II and just after, along with the Racine Belles, but the photograph actually shows some talented women of the Kenosha Comets, and all kinds of wonderful photographs to take us up to the present day. I want to finish real quick by having you talk about a great photograph that is not on the field, but in a restaurant. The headline says, "The Art of the Craft," and the great Ted Williams is sitting down to a meal with two much younger players. Explain why this image is here. It is wonderful, but why did you want to include it?
You know, it's great that you bring this one up. I think of all these pictures, and when you live with them and look at them, I really love so many of them, and it's hard to choose. But in some ways, this is my favorite photograph, or the one that I think about sometimes when I'm away from the book as much or more than any other. So it's Williams, as you said, and he's sitting at a lunch table in Florida during spring training of 1986. And he's there with Don Mattingly and Wade Boggs. And this is at the height of the time when Boggs is, you know, multiple-time batting champion, and Mattingly is in the heart of his MVP-caliber seasons. And they're staring at Ted, who's sort of in a half swing because he's talking hitting, and he's showing the way he turns on a pitch. And you can see the way his hands are on top of one another. It's just such an amazing picture about baseball going generation to generation. One beautiful detail of this is that Williams has a cloth napkin tucked over the front of his shirt to preserve his shirt, which is what men of his age and at that time period did. And the younger men aren't doing that, right? And it's just another detail which underscores the different generations, but they're together around baseball, and
right,
it's an incredible thing.
And you can kind of see the reverence and respect that is on the faces of these young players sitting in the presence of one of the towering legends of the game. It really is a beautiful image. The whole book is wonderful. Again, it's titled The Story of Baseball in 100 Photographs. This is published by Sports Illustrated, and the editor, Kostya Kennedy, also responsible for a really nice introduction for the book. Kostya Kennedy, you've done it again, and I thank you so much for joining me today on The Morning Show to talk about this wonderful book. Best wishes.
Oh, and to you. Thanks so much for having me on. This was really great. I appreciate the time, and so glad you've been enjoying the book.